Session number 790, General Raymond Briggs, Reel 1.
There's one thing I want to correct. There was some form of aptitude tests before me, but I rather developed them.
So then we'll start off with just a few personal questions.
Yes.
What part of the country were you born and brought up in, General?
I was born in Blundell Sands, that's close to Liverpool. And after 5 years, we moved across the water, as they say in those parts, to Birkenhead. So I was mostly brought up in Birkenhead.
And did you go to school in that area?
Yes, I went to Birkenhead School.
Was that a good school?
In those days, it was very good indeed.
What sort of scholar were you?
Not particularly good. Sound, I would say. I was on the classical side.
Yes. And your family? Did you come from an army family?
No, my father was a manufacturer. He had a soap factory in Liverpool itself.
Yes.
Until it was taken over by leavers.
And what's the size of the family?
It was a family of seven. 4 boys and 3 girls. I came next to last.
I see. And your father was a businessman,
yes.
You said. Birkenhead School, tell me a bit about your sort of educational attainments.
Oh, I passed a sort of equivalent of a matriculation thing. I've forgotten the exact name of it now. So, and then I went to the university for a very short time, because I intended to be a surgeon.
Which university was that? Which university?
Liverpool.
I see. Mm-hmm. And was it the First World War that cut your university education short?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you enlisted right at the beginning of the war in August 14.
The 5th of August, yes.
Yes. Just tell me the main experiences that sort of are most vivid and stick with you from your First World War, starting at the beginning.
Well, starting at the beginning, the first was trying to enlist. I went round at least six different units in and around Liverpool before I was able to get into any. The main reason being that in those days, the territorial force, as it was called, they were all waiting until they'd had contact with their own reservists and people who had served with their own units. And so it wasn't until just before midnight on the 5th of August that I was able to enlist in the Liverpool Scottish. I have a good many connections. I had a good many connections in Edinburgh. I had an aunt and various other people, and so was able to give sufficient proof that I had a certain amount of Scottish ancestry.
Yes. So you joined up and you were posted to?
Well, I for some time I was in Liverpool, and during that time we did drill in the park. We were kitted out to a certain extent. There's a curious instance that I got one and tuppence a day, and the tuppence was because I wore my own underwear. They were unable to provide me with underwear.
You had enlisted in the ranks, had you?
Oh, yes.
I see. What were the highlights of the war as far as you were concerned?
Well, the first highlight, of course, was being slightly wounded on Christmas Day 14.
What happened?
In the trenches, a bit of shell splinter in the right knee, and I also had, they called it frostbite, but it's swollen feet, and so I was evacuated to England. Mm-hmm. And after a short period in hospital, and with one of the reserve battalions of Liverpool Scottish in Blackpool, I applied for a regular commission, for a temporary commission, and was granted a temporary commission after a short course at Keble College, Oxford. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, fine. Just carry on with the highlights of the war.
Now,
after
that, I was a second lieutenant, of course, in a reserve battalion, the 10th, of the King's Own Regiment, and stationed first of all in Devonshire and afterwards in Dorset. After having done my training, and in a very short time, I was appointed adjutant of that battalion. One of the chief reasons why was that the CO, who was a very old reservist, a Colonel Bonamy, asked us to write, anybody who'd been overseas, an essay of various things that you ought to do when you take over a trench in France. And apparently my essay was supposed to be sufficiently good to be reproduced almost throughout the army later on. And so I was appointed his adjutant.
And you went to Mesopotamia with that unit?
No, that unit stayed at home as a training regiment. And I went to Mesopotamia, where I joined the 6th Battalion of the King's Own Regiment, which had recently arrived in Mesopotamia from Gallipoli.
How did you find conditions compared in Mesopotamia with those which you'd already experienced in France?
Oh, entirely different. The in France, it was a completely static warfare by that time, by the time I left. An advance of 100 yards was considered almost a victory. And, of course, you had the awful enemy of wet and mud. Whereas in Mesopotamia, you were mostly in fairly firm desert land. And the rainfall was almost predictable. At the time the monsoons came, then you knew you were going to have a certain amount of rain. There was, in France and Belgium, there was always somewhere or other a certain amount of cover, maybe a small hill or a wood or something else like that. Whereas in the desert, except where some of the towns were, and very close to the banks of the river, it was just a desert and nothing else. Mm.
You were wounded also in Mesopotamia. How did that happen?
I was then a temporary captain commanding a company. And on the day of Maud's first advance in 17, as I advanced forward, we had very few casualties. The fire against us was not very intense, but just about nightfall, it was decided, just before nightfall, that we'd better dig in as best as we can. Now, digging in was done with an entrenching tool, which is I don't think they carry them a lot in this last war. It was a small, looked a bit like an axe. One side was a little spade, and the other side was a, and the other end was a pick. And so I went right along the line that my company occupied. On the right was a battalion not belonging to our infantry brigade, and on the left was one of our own battalions, the Loyal North Lancashire Regiment. I went up and down, and everything seemed fairly all right. And by this time, I was slightly weary, so I lay down on my tummy behind our line of so-called entrenchments. And there were none of them very deep. They might have been a foot deep. I think they gave you confidence rather than any protection. And I suppose I was some way behind, not very far, where our troops were. And my orderly said to me, "Can I have a drink of water?" Now, in Mesopotamia, the campaign was almost run on water. We were some slight distance away from the River Tigris and its tributary on the left, the River Hai. We were in the intersection just between those two rivers. So I turned round to him and berated him fairly vigorously, because they had very strict orders as to how much water they had and when it would be issued and when they could drink it. However, I relented. Now, in those days, we didn't have the neat equipment that they had in this war, and an officer had everything slung on one or other shoulder: binoculars, map cases, water bottle, etc., etc. And I lifted myself up on my left hand to its full extent and put my right hand behind my back in order to get hold of the water bottle, when I suddenly felt a tremendous bang pretty low down, somewhere about the groin. And I didn't lose any consciousness or anything like that, but my orderlies saw that I'd flopped a bit, and he looked at me and said, "The blood's pouring out of your neck." So I said, "Well, don't be a fool, put a bandage on," because we all had our own little bandages, as you probably know. I was then taken back to our regimental aid post when it was quite dark, on a stretcher, carried by four Indians, all of whom unfortunately were of differing sizes, and so it was a pretty wobbly journey, I remember.
This led to a period of hospitalization and convalescence in India eventually. Was that a very long period?
Yes, it was a fairly long period, perhaps 4 or 5 months altogether.
Where was that?
That was, first of all, the hospitalization was in the Maharaja Gaikwad of Baroda's palace in Bombay. I was then moved, after I was fit, to a convalescent section in Trimalgiri, which is near Secunderabad, which was in Hyderabad, Deccan.
Yes, I see. And after the 5 month period of convalescence, were you fairly quickly put back into action?
Fairly quickly. I got very bored with having to stay at this convalescent section. I stayed there, and again I was adjutant of that convalescent section. And an Indian Army order came out asking for volunteers for armored cars. And I put in for that appointment and was accepted.
What attracted you to armored cars?
Nothing particularly. It was pure boredom. I wasn't allowed to go back to my infantry and go back to some unit and do things that I knew about. And I was just completely fed up at being at this convalescent section.
Yes. I was wondering whether, after your injury experiences, it seemed like a good scheme to have a sheet of metal around you for a change.
No, I'm afraid it never entered my head then.
Did you have any particular aptitudes or qualifications?
Well, I didn't
really,
because I didn't even drive a car in those days. And I learned to drive a car really up in Peshawar.
This was where you were sent to join an armored car unit, was it?
No, I was sent to join the... it's more than a unit. It was a combination of units. It was really a centre for the armored cars in India.
Where?
Peshawar.
I see. What sort of armored car establishment was at Peshawar?
There was an operative unit, and there was some minor form of a school, not a real school, but a minor form of a school. There was a training establishment that trained in gunnery from armored cars, and in driving.
Tell me about the kind of training you got. Was it a very formal and systematic one?
In those days, no, it wasn't very systematic. It was rather haphazard. There was, seemed to be a rush about everything to get you through so as to get you to take some operational role somewhere or other.
Could you describe exactly what happened? Give me some examples of this haphazardness.
I really couldn't, because it would involve really comparing it with the sort of training that one had when one joined the tank corps much later on.
Well, what stages did they take you through as far as the training you got?
As far as the training they got, as soon as you could drive, then, and as soon as you knew how to shoot the Vickers gun and how to operate and manage the stoppages that occurred, then you were supposed to be trained.
Well, in what sort of circumstances and what ways was the drive? We have a technical.
In India. Before I went out.
Well, perhaps we could just touch on that again. Obviously, you won't be able to remember all the details, but in as far as you're able, could you try and break down the sort of training which was available at that time? With what equipment, the circumstances under which it was given?
The actual training that I got in Mao in the Vickers machine gun was good.
Let's see if we can get back to our conversation. We were talking about the training, and I think that we got so little into it that we might as well consider it as not having been done and start again. So you're at Peshawar with the armored car unit having your initial training, and I'm just interested in some of the details about how this training was given.
Well, the first thing really was the machine gun school in Mao in India, And that was purely for the machine gun. They taught nothing except the gun and how to shoot it and how to remedy any stoppages that you had. There was no tactical training of any kind. And it was essentially for officers who were going to machine gun corps units, not armored units.
I see. So it was essentially learning the weapon.
It was nothing but learning the weapon. Mm-hmm. The training up in Peshawar was first of all driving, and there was no particular method about it. I would really say that it was similar to instruction you'd get almost today, except for signals and things, by an instructor if you took a driving course, just to get a driving license.
Did they vary the terrain very much over which you
had
to
practice? Terrain was considerably varied. There's a good deal of work on roads, because, after all, nobody knew where you were going to be sent. You might be sent to a town, such as Peshawar itself, or you might be sent up into the hills where it was mostly driving on pretty rough tracks, such as the Khyber Pass. A certain amount of training took place up to the opening of the Khyber Pass. At a certain amount, there was very little off the road because, after all, wheeled vehicles in those days didn't really go off the road. There was nothing like a six-wheel truck or anything, or a tracked vehicle or anything like that.
Did you find in practice that, to the extent that you did move off the roads, that the vehicles were rather limited in their capabilities?
Oh, very much limited. They were just as, if not slightly more limited, than even an ordinary car would be.
Mm-hmm. Now, the gunnery aspect of your training with armored cars...
There was practically nothing up there.
You never had opportunity to use the gun in the moving vehicle?
Never. Oh, they wouldn't even dream of using it from a wheeled vehicle.
Under any circumstances?
Well, there might be in a... very doubtful.
But the armored cars were equipped with fixed machine guns, presumably.
Oh, they were.
Which implies they were intended for use from the vehicle.
Oh, they didn't have a turret. They had a limited traverse, perhaps 90 degrees. So you could swing your gun from there to there.
What kind of cars were they?
All sorts of cars. I remember there were quite a lot of Wolseley cars, and I believe a very large number of them were given to the Indian government, I presume, by very wealthy Rajas who gave them the car. The car was then, the body was taken off, and they went to the railway workshops, and in the railway workshops, ordinary iron plate, not armor plate, there wasn't any armor plate out there, was put on in the workshops. There was no attempt at a car having a turret. It's merely put on the sides.
Were there no cars with the unit that were delivered in a complete state from England?
Not then, no. A bit later on, yes.
They were all standard cars which had been modified.
Yes.
What about the gun fixing? Was that done in India?
Yes, in the Indian Army workshops.
Yes. Did you find that the cars had to be much modified after use in the light of your experience of using them?
No, not very much, really. I never fought in one of those cars. I was in operations in aid of the civil power and shot over the heads and shot blank too in Peshawar and in Secunderabad later on.
Could you tell me about the deficiencies and merits of any of the mixture of cars you had to work with?
I mostly worked with the Wolseley cars. I don't remember working with any other cars. It was really an extraordinary outfit because one felt completely cut off. You didn't feel that you belonged to the British Army at all. You thought you were part of the Indian Army.
There was a mixture then of Indian and
well,
British
not,
Army.
Well, not altogether. There were, up in Peshawar, yes. I had crews that had white Royal Army Service Corps drivers. And the rest of the crew, the gunner, and in many cases the sergeant, the Havildar, were Indians. And so you rarely had white soldiers being given orders by an Indian, which in those days was an extraordinary thing. And you would have said it would never have worked, but it did work.
After you'd finished your training at Peshawar, well, where were you posted?
To a place called Trimalgerry, and that is near Secunderabad, and that is, Secunderabad is in the Deccan, Hyderabad, in Hyderabad.
Mm-hmm. And the unit?
The 16th Armoured Motor Battery.
And what sort of establishment did you find when you joined the unit?
I didn't really find one. I didn't really find a complete one. A great many of the soldiers came down from Peshawar.
Hmm. Well, what was the organization and establishment of the battery?
About four of these cars.
Woolsey's?
Woolsey's, all the same. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness. No difficulty about spares if they were required.
So there were four cars, and what did the rest of the establishment consist of in terms of personnel and facilities?
Oh, there'd be fitters who wouldn't travel in the cars.
Mm-hmm. And what were your duties?
My main duty was to act, if required, in aid of the civil power. From time to time, in order to keep the local population subdued, I would have to drive through the streets, not firing at all, but moving my gun from side to side in order to show the population that if trouble happened, they would be for it.
And were the cars effective in that kind of role?
I think so. I never had to. We never really had a riot down there.
So the cars were never used in anger?
No.
Mm-hmm. Now, in 1920, you transferred to the Tank Corps. How did that come about?
It came about because I came home. I was evacuated from India. I had dysentery, actually. And I came to England. When I got to England, I saw a friend at the War Office and said, I think it's about time that I saw my own regiment. I have never served with either of the four regular battalions that there were then, compared with later days. And it's about time I served with them. And he said, I'm very sorry. I'm afraid you can't go to your own regiment yet. The tank corps are forming a number of armored car companies. And so far, there are only two regular officers, yourself and a Captain Herr Hobson of one of the Lancer regiments, who have ever served with armored cars overseas or anywhere. And so that's how I was seconded from the machine gun corps motors to the tank corps.
How did you receive the news of this transfer, which had not...